Now we turn this morning in our study of Luke's Gospel to the parable of the prodigal son. It has often been said that this is a story which holds the very essence of the Gospel of Christ. One writer calls it, in Latin, Evangelium in Evangelio, meaning an evangel inside the evangel. It is good news inside the good news. It is a gospel message inside the gospel message. Evangelium in Evangelio. And there's much that is true in that. Somehow, the parable of the prodigal son is a story which condenses the word of grace. It is the love of God, broad and large, writ small, and scaled down into a story for our understanding. And as you might expect, there are different interpretations of this parable. Can I just mention two before we come to the heart of the message? The first interpretation is this. It's sometimes suggested that what we have here is an allegory of the Gentiles coming home to God. The story tells of two sons. One of them is near the father, and he stands for the Jews. They were the religious people. They were always used to the Father's presence. They lived in the Father's house. They were the insiders near the Father and always serving him. And so the older son represents the Jews, the nation that was near God. The younger son is also a son of the father, but he chooses to be a wanderer. And he drifts away from the father's house and into the far country, which Jesus calls the outer darkness. And there, in the outer darkness of the Gentiles, this younger son wastes his life and squanders the gifts that the Father has given him. And Paul describes this younger Gentile son in Ephesians chapter 2 in this way. And he's comparing the Gentiles in the darkness with the Jews in the light of the Father's house. And he says, writing to these Gentiles, remember that at one time you Gentiles were separated from Christ. You were alienated from the nation of Israel, having no hope and without God in the world. But now, in Christ Jesus, you who once were far off have been brought near. For he is our peace, who has made us, the older son and the younger son, both one, and has reconciled us both to God. A parable and an allegory of the Gentiles coming home to God. And if that's a true understanding of the prodigal son, then the message is there is room for outsiders in the Father's house. There is room in the house of God for the broken and the ruined and the wandering sons and daughters of men living in the outer darkness. Christ receiveth sinful men. This man receives sinners and eats with them. The Gentiles may come in from the outer darkness and sit down in the Father's house. The second interpretation is this, that there in fact are three prodigals in this story. First of all, of course, there is the prodigal son, and he has come down to us as the prototype of the waster, the no good, the black sheep of the family, the profligate, and the ne'er-do-well, who is such a heartbreak and an embarrassment to the family. I'm sure you know of such a boy. Thomas a Kempis, the great medieval theologian, once described the road to damnation in this way. Kempis says, at first there comes to the mind simply a thought. Then strong imagination. Then consent. And so by degrees the enemy gains full possession. First of all, we think about it. And then we imagine it. And then we consent. That is the path of the prodigal son. And in the words of a contemporary pop song, it really is the road to hell. First of all, you think about it, and then you imagine it, and then you consent. There's a second prodigal in this story. It is the prodigal father, and it is his prodigality that stands at the heart of the parable, not the wanderings of the younger son, but the immensity of the Father's love and the vastness and the prodigality of his care for the boy. The word prodigal is a word that speaks to us of excess. Prodigality is something that overflows and spills over in its generosity and its magnanimity. And it is that kind of love which makes this man a prodigal father. And it is that kind of love which marks out the God of the gospel as a prodigal God. And there is a third prodigal. He is the older brother who stayed at home and worked for the father in the fields. And he is just as much a prodigal as his brother who went to the far country. Of course, he had not lived an outrageous life. He had kept the law and his father's commands, but he was just as much adrift from his father's heart as his younger brother. People looking at him would have said, "What a good living lad that is." Or, "My, there's a devoted son for you." But one of the commentators says that the older brother was a prodigal because he was at home, but not at home. You ever felt that feeling? You're at home, but you're not at home. Have you ever known young people like that? They're at home, but they're not at home. Three prodigals. And there is something to commend that understanding of the story. It certainly is true that there is a prodigality in people who go away and live it up and squander their father's substance, and then at the last come home to God, ruined souls, wasted and spoiled with the ashes of their burned out lives. It's also true that the heart of the gospel is the message of a prodigal father whose heart burns and overflows with love for the wanderers and the estranged. And it's also true that there can be a prodigality in the son who stays at home, in the father's house, surrounded by religion and prayers and church traditions, and who has allowed himself to become self-righteous. Three characters, and all of them prodigals. But I believe that although these two understandings are valid, they do not reach the heart of this great story. You see, the richness of the parable of the prodigal son lies in this. First of all, it teaches us the marks of a prodigal. And secondly, it teaches us the marks of true penitence. I'd like to think of these very briefly this morning. First of all, the marks of a true prodigal. And they are twofold. And the first is this: a prodigal is somebody who lives in the far country. Not many days later, verse 13, the younger son gathered all he had and took his journey into a far country. And the point of being in the far country was that he was adrift from his father and far from home. And that is what it means to be a prodigal. Adrift from the father and far from home. And according to the Bible, it is not necessary to fall into deep sin or to live a notorious lifestyle in order to be in the far country. There are people in Inverness today sitting by their firesides, leading decent, respectable lives, but who are in the far country. There are men and women in Inverness today lying in bed, reading their Sunday papers, rotting their way to judgment and eternity. Nice people. But they are in the far country. There are people sitting in church pews today who, spiritually speaking, are in the far country. There are judges sitting on benches in courts of law. There are policemen upholding law and order in the land. There are ministers standing in pulpits. There are religious people in the kirks, none of whom would ever land in jail or dream of living notoriously, but all of whom have this one mark: they are living in the far country. And that is the mark of a prodigal. Adrift from God and far from home. I wonder if there's a prodigal in church here this morning who is adrift from God and far from home, living in the far country. The second mark of a true prodigal is this: he is consumed with self-centeredness. This boy came to his father and he said in verse 12, "Father, give me the share of property that falls to me." And that was a shocking thing to do, because the old man was still alive. But the boy wanted from his father what was coming to him in the father's will. Right now he wanted it. He could not wait till his father died. He wanted the cash here and now. Give me what is coming to me. That's the mark of a prodigal. Give me. Give me. A self-centered, self-concerned, and a self-preoccupied life. And it is from that self-centeredness that insatiable desire of our egos to be satisfied, that we need to be saved. We need to be delivered from the tyranny of our egos. I, me, my, mine, give me. One preacher has put it like this: ego seated enthroned in the heart of man, will do anything if only it is allowed to go on living. It will enter the ministry or go to the mission field. It will scrub floors and dig other people's gardens. It will put itself to all manner of inconveniences. It will serve the church and engage in religious duties. It will sit on committees, however boring they may be. Ego will do all of this if only it is allowed to go on living. I had a friend once who decided to go to the mission field. So she went to London to a missionary training center to study. And another of her friends happened to be in London and called to see her and found her down on her knees scrubbing the corridors. "What on earth are you doing down there?" she said. "Is this preparing you for the mission field?" And she replied, "This is what they do to make you humble." If only it were as easy as that. You see, ego will scrub floors. If only it is allowed to go on living. Father, give me the self-centeredness of an uncrucified ego is the mark of a prodigal. But this is a story which also tells us the two marks of true penitence. The first is this. In verse 17 we read these great words, "He came to himself." That is the first cardinal mark of penitence towards God, an awareness of what it means to be adrift from God and far from home. He came to himself. And that was the most arresting and the most riveting discovery the prodigal ever made. It is the most shattering discovery any man or woman can make. He came to himself. Have you come to yourself? I came to myself 34 years ago, and I was appalled by what I saw. Let me tell you a story about Mrs. Ceaușescu, killed with her husband. She was apparently a rather vulgar woman. She'd been brought up in a remote peasant village, and she was forever giving away the fact that in spite of all the chandeliers and diamonds, she really was rather tasteless and common. One day, Mrs. Ceaușescu was visiting Paris. She was taken to see the Louvre Gallery. And if you are a vulgar, tasteless person, the Louvre Gallery is just the very place to bring it out. And she brought it out in style, making mistakes, getting the paintings wrong, identifying the wrong artists. Everybody was so embarrassed. And at one point, Mrs. Ceausescu stopped and said, "Look at that hideous Picasso." And the French guide turned to her and said, "But Madame, that is a mirror." At the end of the road of your wanderings, at the end of your rebellions and your refusals of Christ, at the end of your prodigalities adrift from God and home, God holds up a mirror. And as you stand before the mirror, you see yourself as you really are. He came to himself. Have you come to yourself yet? The second mark of true penitence is this. You find it in verse 18. He said, "I will arise and go to my Father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven." You see, all sin, first of all, is sin against God. We're less conscious of this than we are of sinning against ourselves and sinning against others. Of course, we do hurt other people when we sin. We hurt our parents. Husbands hurt their wives. Wives hurt their husbands. Friends hurt friends. Parents hurt their children. We're very conscious of that. But first of all, to sin is to sin against God. It is what we have done to God rather than what we have done to our fellows. That is the real issue here. David said in the penitential psalm, the 51st psalm, against thee only have I sinned and done that which is evil in thy sight. You see, David was primarily conscious not of his sin against Bathsheba or against Bathsheba's husband whose murder he had arranged. He was conscious, first of all, of his sinfulness in the sight of God. "I will arise and go to my Father and say, Father, I have sinned against heaven and you." And that's the second hallmark of true penitence, an awareness of what our sin has done to God. There is one last word. Frederick Faber says in one of his hymns, "The music of the gospel leads us home, and home is the place of understanding, the place of love, It's the place of safety. It's where you can be understood, loved, and safe. And the music of the gospel leads us home. The last word is not about the prodigality of the boy, nor even of his penitence, but about the waiting father. In verse 20 we read that the father ran and embraced him and kissed him. But the Greek says, kate philesen, which means smothered his face with kisses. This wasn't a genteel peck on the cheek. It was a roaring welcome home. Kate philesen. He smothered the boy's face with kisses. I was reading recently about John Peyton, that great missionary to the New Hebrides last century. John Peyton had a waster of a brother called Walter. And Walter was the black sheep of the family. And when he was a young man, Walter Peyton left home, joined the Navy, and vanished. But every night, for the rest of her life, Mrs. Peyton would go down to the door, lift the latch, and leave the door standing ajar all night, so that whenever Walter came home from the far country, he would find a welcome. Kate philesen. He smothered his face with kisses. There is that kind of welcome for you this morning, and for all who come home again, home to the Father's house, and home to the Father's love. Will you do it? You who are in the far country, adrift from God and far from your true home, will you do it? Will you do it today? Amen. May God bless the preaching of the word. To his name be honor and praise. We sing in closing hymn number 687, and we sing the first two verses and the last verse only. Three verses, because the time has gone. The first two verses and the last of hymn 687, Lord, I hear of showers of blessings.